In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, November 7th, 2014. The end of another week of programming, but wait till you hear what's coming up next week. I'll tell you about that when we get to the end. Right now, I want to welcome back to the show our old friend Michael Malice. Michael is the author, most recently, of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. You can catch him from time to time on The Independents on Fox Business, and he's always a blast to talk to. Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
I've done some election analysis a little bit with Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center, looking at some of the 10th Amendment-related or nullification, marijuana stuff and all that. But you now have a completely, well, I don't know. I don't want to say you're a school of one. I'm sure there are people who follow you on this. But you're going to try to persuade me that what anarcho-capitalists should be cheering for in 2016 is a Hillary Clinton presidency. I would like to hear the case for that.
Oh, desperately. This is such a no-brainer to me that I'm surprised that more anarcho-capitalists don't see it. So let's start with two facts about Hillary Clinton that are completely indisputable. Number one, when she was given her first government position in 1994, maybe she started in 93, healthcare, she bungled it so badly that she caused the Democrats their first congressional loss in 40 years. That's number one. Number two, and this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it speaks to the truth, how badly in America do you have to blow the job interview that they give the gig to the black guy who doesn't even have a resume? This is what happened to her in 2008. This woman is a walking calamity. Let's talk about what she did this year. She was on NPR with Terry Gross. NPR, as you know, is not particularly amenable to liberty. Terry Gross is hardly a firebrand, but she's, you know, a doctrinaire, urban progressive. And she asked Hillary, this, and the audio is online. This isn't some secret. This is on NPR. She asked Hillary, you know, you used to be against gay marriage and now you're for it. How did your position change? You know, very natural, innocuous question. And Hillary starts blithering about how America's evolved, so on and so forth, and we need leaders. And Terry Gross just asks her, like, yeah, that's great. How have you personally evolved? And Hillary says to her, Terry, you are accusing me of changing my position for political purposes. Now, how far removed do you have to be from reality to consider Terry Gross to be some kind of covert Republican operative or covert libertarian operative? And how tin-eared do your political instincts have to be to accuse her of this on the air? To go after the reporter as the enemy. I mean, this woman is completely out of her mind. And once she's in office, I think states recede in power, not through having good politicians, there's no such thing, but through the incompetence of bad ones. I think that's the only hope we have for any kind of political progress in terms of rolling back the state.
All right. Look, I mean, I could see an argument from the worse the better, which is a Walter Block view sometimes, although he tends to, if he votes, he thinks in terms of which candidate is likely to be less bellicose, let's say, because he thinks that's a big issue. But couldn't you say, I mean, let me make the case for, you get Rand Paul in office, and Rand appoints some people we're going to hate, inevitably, but some decent people, some decent work gets done in the various departments. Maybe there's some rolling back of the state. Maybe there is some curtailing of the aggressive foreign policy. I mean, maybe there's some movement in the direction of liberty. Maybe for four years. Wait, hang on a second. For 4 years, people at least get the possibility of being exposed to pro-Austrian economists that they've never, you know, a whole school of thought they never heard of before. There's at least a remote chance under Rand they'd get 4 years of education. I mean, that's something, right?
We're getting 4 years. We're getting 8 years of education now through this show under Obama, aren't we? I mean, it's not like if Hillary Clinton is in office, like all these views are censored. If anything, if Hillary Clinton's in office, that's further proof that the progressive myth is a failure and people are going to be searching for answers, especially disillusioned young women who bought into the narrative that she's this great feminist icon, and when they see that she's a complete incompetent, they're going to be looking for rational answers instead of some myth that this, you know, that just because this person happens to be a female, she's going to save this country.
Yeah, fair enough. But I mean, couldn't you just as easily say that we should have expected that after 2 years of Obama, and many people voted for him because they thought it would be great to have the first black president, in the same way that some people will vote for Hillary because she'll be the first woman?
Sure.
Shouldn't they have learned by the end of this, seeing that? Yeah, I'm sure none of them really believe that there's a major economic recovery going on. So maybe you would think at this point they would be looking for answers, and yet they're all running around with their idiotic ready for Hillary signs. Maybe they don't learn.
What about the – I'm sorry, Tom. What about 2010 and the Tea Party and the fact that this is the first time we had any kind of coherent – organized pro-liberty, I'm obviously not a Tea Party member, but any kind of organized, coherent anti-government movement in this country for quite a long time? Are you forgetting about this? Are you forgetting about the huge rise in libertarianism as a function of Obama being president, and also, of course, as a function of George Bush's incompetence and his completely destroying the Republican brand as a vehicle for spreading liberty even at home or abroad?
Those are all wonderful things, and I will concede them to you gladly. On the other hand, I saw a recent poll that finds the older generation looks upon the word socialism unfavorably, but about 15% of the so-called millennials look favorably on the word socialism. These people are hopeless.
Are you looking for democratic solutions for liberty? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'm just telling you they don't learn. Your point is that maybe they'll learn after years of failure under Hillary.
No.
They don't. They're idiots.
They're not going to. I'm sorry. I agree with you completely. They're not going to. Okay. We're on the same page here. Yes. I am more elitist than you. I assure you. I have no hope of people learning. Zero. My hope is I do not. When people ask me why I'm an anarchist, I say it in one sentence. I do not believe in political solutions to social problems. That's anarchism to me in one sentence, and I'm sure you'd agree with that. If she is in there discrediting politics as a mechanism for political solution, her venality, her inability to – she lies about – she said that she was named after Edmund Hillary, even though he climbed Mount Everest after she was born. The woman cannot help but lie. Not only that, she's Nixonian, but she's bad at it. So she uses the state to kind of crush her political opponents and people she doesn't like, but she does it ham-fistedly and transparently. And the one thing that Republicans are good for, and it's not going to be cutting the budget, Tom, the one thing Republicans are good for is taking out the knives and going after people personally. Daryl Issa and Peter King and all these others, they could not wait to start taking her apart and having these investigations and completely destroying her personally. And as a consequence, her vaunted air of competence will be destroyed in days.
Well, let me tell you another thing Republicans are good at, bootlicking. So suppose you get a Rand Paul president. I'm just playing devil's advocate here to make this fun. Suppose you get a Rand Paul president. All of a sudden, it'll be fashionable to be kind of libertarian. And these people are like, you know, rabid dogs. You know, there's something fashionable that's being draped before them. They're going to leap for it.
Well, I don't think they're rabid dogs. I think they're non-rabid dogs and that they follow the herd. They follow the pack. Right. So, yes, there is a sense that Rand Paul, if he becomes president, that the Republicans will start singing libertarian tunes to a point. However, you also surely would agree that virtually all of these Republicans are beholden to some agency or some group, and they are not in a position via politics to implement libertarian ideas. You know, they're bought and paid for, and there's no other alternative than to be bought and paid for. And this is why politics is not a mechanism for freeing a country.
All right, let me ask you this. Now, this is sort of unfair because it's a state-level question. And on the state level, politicians can do somewhat less damage for a variety of reasons. But we just, of course, we had the gubernatorial race in Kansas, and, of course, we had the election a few days ago. And Sam Brownback came out ahead, even though the polls, most of the polls were showing him losing this election. And he came, and for most of the night, he was losing. As the numbers came in, he was behind. And then suddenly he shot ahead. Now, I like Keen Umber. I've had him over to my house. He was the Libertarian candidate. He's my preferred guy. But my view in at the state level is that I don't go for this. The Democrats, the Republicans are indistinguishable. At the state level, they're clearly not. Because under Brownback, I don't pay any state income tax anymore because he passed a initiative saying that if you earn self-employment income, that's not subject to state income tax. Well, you know, that's I got a 15 grand tax refund because of that. I mean, that's great. That means I don't have to fly around the country as much anymore. I can spend more time with my family. That's a practical way in which my life was improved because of this situation, and it would have been taken away from me if the Pinko had been elected. So why should I say I want the Republican to win?
I'm going to be glib and tweak your nose a little and say, Tom Woods, I look at the data, and I only look at the data, and you're not looking at the data. What the data says is when we have a leftist doctrinaire president, we have the most Republican governors and state houses in 100 years. Is that not what the facts say? Is this not a function of Obama?
Well, I mean, maybe you scored a point, but I'm trying. No, hold on now. Hold on. I'm trying to score a point on an issue we haven't yet really brought up, which is the issue of voting versus non-voting. And I don't really take a dogmatic view of this. I feel like I voted for Ron Paul just because I felt like the guy's working so darn hard. I would feel like I'm spitting in his face by not taking the 2 seconds to go vote. But I realize, yeah, I know your vote isn't going to make the difference. Like, I understand all the things. If I voted, it would be just to feel like part of the movement. And there's almost never anybody I feel that I would want to vote for. But the point is, the idea that, well, nothing's really going to change by voting clearly is untrue because my taxes are much lower now because voting took place for this particular individual, right?
So if you hadn't voted, the outcome would have been different?
Okay, I understand. It makes no rational sense for a given individual, but the collective entity, the collective process of voting. No, that's why I stopped myself. The process yielded this outcome. The process yielded this outcome of phone banks and organizing people and getting them to the polls yielded you the outcome of lower taxes for me.
Yeah, okay, that's great. I want to abolish taxes. I don't want to just lower them. I'm not a moderate.
Okay, and we did we abolished the state income tax, and I feel like we should extend this loophole to the whole state. I'd like to see that happen, but I can't say to myself, "Well, all political activity is a waste of time," because 15 grand tells me it's not.
But where are you saying that I'm saying this? All I'm saying is that what you're asking for is a consequence of a reaction. Like I said earlier.
No, I get that, but I'm thinking about your Guardian piece about not voting.
Okay.
So I've unjustifiably thrown that into the mix without telling you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm familiar with that article having written it, so I'll be glad to address it. So let me just talk to the audience briefly.
Okay.
So what you're referring to is I wrote a piece for the Guardian, which is that far left British newspaper, about why I personally don't vote. And there are two things in that article that I specifically say. Number one is I reject completely, and I think this is a function of progressivism that maybe you might not be falling into. I'm very curious to hear what you are. The Kantian universability principle, which means the statement that if I am going to morally do something, it should be something that I can advocate everyone do. I reject that completely. A big function of hardcore progressive leftism is this idea that the personal is the political, that what I do should be replicated nationwide in the social sphere. And I think that's absolute madness. I don't agree that if you say, well, if everyone acted the way you do, then what would happen? I'm an outlier. I will never be in a situation, even among ANCAP circles, where everyone acts the way I do. So I think it's a very false thing to say, if I do something, therefore I'm advocating for other people to do or not do, or refrain from this, because their value is subjective, and they can live their lives however they wish.
All right, well then, I guess my follow-up to that would be, I have heard many, many times the case against voting. And again, in practice, there's almost never anybody worth voting for, so it is partly an academic dispute we're having about the issue of voting in general, which I know is not the topic we started with, but I do want to hit on it because it is somehow relevant. But I, you know, people say, look, that's, you're never going to get what you want through voting. And that's true. I mean, in the, I'm not going to get the kind of society ultimately that I want through voting. The whole system is corrupt, and it's necessarily so. It's not just because bad people are involved. I totally understand that. But what I don't understand is when people say, you shouldn't do this, you're just playing the state's game, or, you know, you can never get the masses to do the right thing, it makes me wonder, then what is your vision of social change whereby we do get what we want and it doesn't involve politics? Now, I can imagine a misanthrope, which sometimes I am, frankly, saying, well, look, look, there isn't one. There is no path to a free society. You've got to just carve out as much freedom for yourself as you can. And if the masses want to enslave themselves, then let them go do it. But what is your response?
Well, first of all, I would just, the argument against voting, which I didn't touch in the Guardian article, because I'm very loath to give people advice on how to live their lives. I think that's a kind of inappropriate thing to do in general. But what I would point out with voting is the opportunity cost. Because if you want to, you know, if someone wants to make a difference, that 1 hour it takes to go vote, you can, you know, foster a puppy, you can, you know, mentor a kid, go to an old folks home where people are lonely and just spend time with them. I mean, there's a lot of things that 1 hour of time can do that I think people would much rather be in some kind of mass movement than to actually sit down and with minimal effort, you know, increase utility in another being's life enormously. So that's why I would say I'm actually opposed to voting, not in terms of practicality, but in terms of opportunity cost. Now, in terms of what is the answer if it's not politics, in my view, the only progress that has happened, you know, in the last decades has been completely a function of technology and philosophy. It has been a function of decreasing the ability of the masses to control other people's lives. Let's look at it this way. Let's say 30 years ago, like, you know, 1984, it would be very easy to completely censor effectively, not legally, any sort of pro-freedom ideas because you had three networks and maybe PBS, right? Milton Friedman might be the only counterexample, if that. Now you have a million networks and you have the internet. It is effectively impossible to hold these ideas censored and quiet. And in fact, this is, I think, a big reason why you have such a growth of pro-freedom ideas, because, you know, back when you and I were kids, Tom, that libertarian, that freak in high school that no one wants to talk to, and now you go online, you're like, hey, you're not a freak, you're just an outlier who's pretty smart and got it figured out, and there's lots of other people like you, and that psychological need for community, which all humans have, has been met, and that fosters these ideas going forward. And technology, I think, is the only thing that's going to prevent the state, because if the state has a gun, there's no reason it's not going to use it.
Last time you were on the program, we talked about your book, Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. How can you bring North Korea into the mix when talking about U.S. politics? It seems like such a caricature of the state. Does it have anything to teach us at all here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, I only in the last month, there's this whole, this is a whole big segment which I won't get into with this whole Gamergate nonsense. And how people are having their, you know, lives destroyed and their, you know, information made public. And there's so many people who are getting fired simply because something they've tweeted or something, you know, they've written in a blog post 8 years ago. And working in the North Korean space and growing up in a Soviet household, it only recently became apparent to me that this is something that Americans don't get, but that has been beaten into me since I was a kid, which is, when you grow up in North Korea, or if you grew up in a Russian household, you are taught, and I don't know if I was taught this explicitly or intuitively, but you are taught to always be aware of who has power over you, and to always be aware that they will have no problem using it for absolutely arbitrary reasons. So there was a book written about me called Ego and Hubris, and there was an anecdote in there where I had a minor discussion in a business class in college. And the next day when I came back, the teacher had written me a letter saying, until I apologize for challenging him about the nature of copyright, I would not be allowed to speak in class. And it was absolutely crazy. It made no sense because it's not like our voices were raised or I was, you know, kicked out of the class. It was just a complete – and it was on topic. You know, it wasn't – I was attacking personally. So I took that letter and I said I went to his boss and I almost got him fired. But that's something that, you know, North Korea, someone from North Korea, someone from Russia would never do. You don't put it in writing. So I think what people need to understand, learning the North Korean lesson, is the NSA is watching. The left is watching. You have to be very, very careful of what's going on, and things in this country are going to get a lot worse before they get better. And these people will use any mechanism they have to destroy you personally or politically or professionally. And I think a lot of libertarians are a little naive because they're shocked when cops are doing these things or people are getting arrested for arbitrary grounds, but that's the nature of the state.
I want to ask a completely off-the-wall question that you didn't see coming, but I want to know how Michael Malice came to hold the views of Michael Malice. How did you get on this track in the first place?
Oh, this is a great, great story. Okay? This is a great story. And you're going to laugh, and I'm fine with it because I understand the absurdity.
Okay.
When I was a kid, there was a television show called, what was it called? Family Ties. And it had Michael J. Fox playing Alex P. Keaton.
Yeah.
He was the only person on television who looked like me and reminded me of me because he was snarky. But he was also very smart. And he kind of was this little guy with a lot of guff to him. And I never could watch the show. I resented it enormously because they made a clown out of him. I felt moral umbrage that this character wasn't being put on a pedestal and was, you know, treated sometimes dismissively. So he was my role model growing up. In second grade, I had an attaché case that I would bring to school, trying to look like a little yuppie. It must have been incredibly adorable in retrospect. And growing up in New York, you know, espousing these kind of, they would certainly not be libertarian, espousing these conservative views is really a great way to be obnoxious and to be a punk. Because when you have teachers who have just indoctrinated in, you know, just thoughtless, progressive, you know, nonsense, as opposed to, there's plenty of thoughtful progressives, but most of them don't become, you know, middle school, high school educators. And I would antagonize them constantly to my great delight, and they would not have answers for me because they weren't too bright. And this was a source of great, great pleasure. So when I went to college, I thought I was a Republican. And then I started reading Rand. I don't remember who it was. I was in the student lounge, and the Laissez-Faire Books catalog was just sitting there. And I was like, oh, what's this? And I start looking through it. And there's Andrea Rich on the back, you know, sitting in a stack of books. And all these books look very, very interesting. And I started reading them. And then I was in this bookstore in Manhattan's Upper West Side. And I was looking through the Ayn Rand books because the covers all had an Art Deco style. Nicholas Gaetano made them. I thought they were very appealing. And I was reading the back cover of Atlas Shrugged, and it was described as, this is the story of the man who said he could stop the motor of the world and did. And I thought this was a science fiction novel a la Ghostbusters 2, because Ghostbusters 2, there's this literal engine underneath Manhattan that kind of has gears in the thing. It's like, okay, there's some kind of gear in the center of the world. And I was going to pick it up, and the guy next to me yelled at me. I didn't know who he was. He goes, no, you have to read Anthem first. If you like it, then you read The Fountainhead, and then you read Atlas Shrugged. And that's exactly what I did, and it really opened my eyes. Then I interned at Cato, and I was still kind of a young Republican, and they knocked a lot of sense into me, not enough. And the older I got, you know, the more I started reading about elite theory and kind of mob theory and social psychology, and that really made any kind of appeal to politics go by the wayside. And, of course, North Korea completely solidified my impressions of the state and the nature of the state.
All right, let me jump in with a couple comments on that. First, on Michael J. Fox, I used to watch Family Ties regularly as a kid growing up in the 80s. What I found interesting later on, looking back on it, was how badly the left portrays conservatives. They don't understand what conservatives believe at all. They don't even take 5 minutes to try to understand. So they portray this young conservative as having a portrait of Nixon on his night table. Like Nixon?
Right.
The guy,
right.
Who, I mean, I could go on. I was trying to list them when I had Pat Buchanan on, who tried to make the case for Nixon. I was listing all his outrages. Why would a conservative support him? Or he does a term paper. Alex Keaton paper on why Hoover was a great president. That's not our view.
Well, he's a conservative. He wasn't a libertarian. But let me just jump in here and circle back to what I was talking about earlier. Look at everything that happened under Nixon for the left. Are you telling me that Hillary Clinton, her psychology is not Nixonian to the core?
Oh, and I agree. I thought it was an apt comparison. Now, on Ayn Rand, though, let me jump in on that. I read all her novels, and I actually didn't like Anthem at all. The others I really did like. And I actually thought that my entry point was We the Living, which I think is overlooked too much. Because, of course, We the Living is set in, you know, in the Soviet Union where she herself grew up. And it's a very, very compelling story and shouldn't be missed.
In fact, a friend of mine who owns Rothbard.com, he never read Rand. And he asked me what he should read, and I recommended actually *We the Living*, because if he's already an ANCAP, he doesn't need to be persuaded. But that story really is kind of tugs at your heartstrings. It's very emotional, and it's very chilling because it's not some fantasy alternate universe America like Atlas Shrugged is. This is real life, and this is what the state really means in practice.
You know, and I love there's an exchange in there. I remember it after all these years. I must have read that when I was 21, maybe. I mean, a really long time. That's a half a lifetime ago for me. But I remember an exchange in which the young woman is talking to the communist, and the communist is saying to her, "Let me guess, you admire my ideals, but you loathe my methods." And she says, "I loathe your ideals." That's awesome.
But I like your methods. And then when Rand reissued the book in 1959, she cut that out.
She did? It's the best part.
It was the original... Okay, so let's talk about Rand a little. So originally, and you can see coming that this is a play on words, right? She's like, I loathe your ideals, but I love your methods. Maybe I wouldn't go as far as you. So she says originally Rand struck that in 1959. So We the Living came out in 1936, 1,500 copies. It started selling well, but then the publisher Macmillan had destroyed the plates and it went out of print. They re-released it in 1959, and when they did that, this is after the success of Atlas Shrugged from 1957, Rand went through with the fine-tooth comb and made some edits, and this was one of the big edits that she made. And if you read journals of, look, I'm not a fan of the Ayn Rand Institute, I think they're loopy and beyond belief. If you read a book called Journals of Ayn Rand, and this was actually a publication of her journal showing her thought processes, it's very interesting, and the editor, I believe it's, I'm looking at it right here, it's David Harriman. He admits, as he goes through it, that Rand was originally heavily influenced by Nietzsche. But as she grew up, all the Nietzscheanism dissipated it, like he describes it as water off a leaf, leaving no residue whatsoever. And I'm like, has this person ever met another human being? How is that psychologically possible for someone to have a profound influence on your philosophical development to leave literally no trace as you grew up? I think it's just absolute madness. But that's how they regard her, you know. So... I agree with you completely about We the Living. It's an absolutely amazing book and very, very overlooked.
All right, listen, we're going to cut it off here because you and I could just go on forever, as indeed we did when we finally met in person last month in New York City, and our lunch became two lunches because my wife was back in the hotel room, and you and I just kissed blah, 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 blah the whole lunchtime. And I called her up, and I said, "This guy is great. You got to come out for lunch with us, too." So you came. You're a good sport. You went out for a second lunch with us so that she could meet you, and we just had a fantastic time.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
I loved it. Yeah.
So I'm going to, of course, look you up the next... I mean, I try to get to New York at least once or twice a year, so the Michael Malice lunch is now a fixture of my time there. Well, listen, thanks for your time today. Let's get people to visit you over at michaelmalice.com, and of course, you've got your social media links there as well, and people can catch you as a semi-regular, I think, over on The Independence on Fox Business.
That's right, yeah. Where I tweak the establishment in the state on a regular basis.
Well, thanks again. I appreciate, especially you were pinch hitting for someone who fell through. And boy, this was great. I like somebody who goes toe to toe with me like that. That was good. We got to do more of that.
I love it, Tom. All right. I absolutely love it.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. Before I let you in on what's going on next week, let me remind you that my new book is out. It's zingy. It's fun. It's informative. It's why you listen to this show. It's called Real Dissent: A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. Find out about it at realdissent.com. You can get the audiobook that I narrate for free if you haven't yet gotten a free audiobook through tomwoodsaudio.com. You are entitled to one, and I narrate Real Dissent myself. Of course, you can get the Kindle edition of the book, too, at realdissent.com or at Amazon. But you can also get it as a supporter of this show. If you enjoy these programs and you're benefiting from them, then consider becoming a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. And in addition to the Kindle edition of Real Dissent, you get lots of other great goodies. The courses that I've prepared, hundreds of lessons that I've prepared for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, these are all advanced, so you won't feel talked down to when you listen to them. All kinds of things just for you guys, plus a lot of discounts and transcripts of all the interviews. So check that out over at supportinglisteners.com. Now let's look at what's coming up next week. Next week, we're going to start off with Jim Grant. Jim Grant, if you don't know this guy, is just going to be such a treat to listen to because he's super smart, but he's also very punchy. He's just an outstanding guest anytime you see him on one of these financial shows. And Ron Paul invited him to testify at one of his hearings, and he just stole the show. Absolutely fantastic. And it turns out he has a brand new book on, guess what? The Forgotten Depression of 1920 to 21, a topic I've written and spoken about myself. So we'll definitely get into that. Ben Swan returns to the program. He's a favorite of the listeners here. Murray Polner. Murray Polner, I wrote a book with. He and I are co-editors of the book We Who Dared to Say No to War, American Anti-War Writing from 1812 to Now, a collection of the best anti-war writings and speeches from all the major American wars of the past 200 years. A very interesting collection published by Basic Books, and I've never had Murray as a guest on the show. And the neat thing about that collection is that Murray is on the left, and I am, well, not on the left. But we came together to work on this project because we both thought it was important, and we thought it was neat that we came from different intellectual traditions and yet could agree on this. So that'll be a lot of fun. George Reisman returns to the show to evaluate Hillary Clinton's statement about who creates jobs. Is it corporations or is it aggregate demand? Are you creating jobs when you go out and buy stuff at the store? We'll sort that all out with George Reisman. And finally, we will talk to Alex Epstein, author of the forthcoming book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. We will talk to him on the release date of that book, which is next Thursday, November 13th. So make sure and join us for these episodes. And if you haven't subscribed yet, think of the terrible tragedy of missing out on one of these precious gems. You can subscribe for free via iTunes or Stitcher using the convenient little buttons you'll find over at TomWoodsRadio.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.